You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Maloney, and I'm the Vice President and Director of Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. It's a pleasure to welcome you here today to our conversation on foreign policy and the U.S. presidential election. This event is part of the Brookings Policy 2020 series, which seeks to empower voters with fact-based, data-driven, nonpartisan information to better understand the policy matters discussed by candidates running for office this year. Thank you all for joining us. We're 29 days away from November 3rd. Americans will cast their ballot for the next president, but the future of America's global role is also at the ballot today. Looking toward the election, today's conversation will focus in particular on its implications for the transatlantic relationship and U.S. foreign policy toward Europe. European leaders, along with many of their counterparts around the world, are watching the election closely. While there are differing views about how the outcome in November will shape the transatlantic relationship, few in Europe believe that it will revert to its previous form. Recent polling from the European Council on Foreign Relations on European views of the transatlantic relationship shows that France and Germany see a need to prepare for long-term disengagement from the U.S., regardless of the outcome of the election. This polling also finds that irrespective of the result, no EU member state would seek to position Europe as a third power between the U.S. and China. Today's discussion will assess the stakes of the election and its implications for U.S. foreign policy. I'm delighted to be joined by an outstanding panel of Brookings experts who will offer insights and analysis about what we can expect from either a second Trump term or a Biden presidency. They will also consider how a geopolitical Europe would react to either scenario. Before we dive into the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to thank the Turkish Business and Industry Association for their support and collaboration, which has helped to make this event possible. We're grateful to TÜSİAD for the renewed support of our Center on the U.S. and Europe, and we look forward to continuing our successful partnership with them. As always, an ironclad commitment to scholar independence is at the center of Brookings Institution policies and values, and the views expressed today here are solely those of the speakers. Once again, thank you all for joining us this morning. And now over to Tom Wright, Director of the Center on the U.S. and Europe.
Suzanne, thank you so much for that introduction. And thank you to all of you for joining us online this morning. When we first devised this panel concept a few weeks ago, we thought it would be an eventful October with lots of things to discuss. I don't think any of us could have quite envisaged the circumstances in which we find ourselves this morning. And so to talk about that and the broader sort of implications of the election for transatlantic relations and foreign policy in general, we're fortunate to be joined by a terrific panel of my colleagues from Brookings. So I'll just briefly introduce them, although I'm sure they're all well known to you. We're first joined by Bill Galston. Bill is the Ezra K. Zilke Chair and Senior Fellow in Governance Studies, and has done immense work on the election on U.S. politics, but the connection to foreign policy, America's role in the world. Fiona Hill, my colleague at the Center for the United States and Europe, a senior fellow in foreign policy, and of course, formerly the senior director for Europe and Russia in the White House during the Trump administration. And Celia Ballon, who is a visiting fellow in the Center for the U.S. and Europe in Foreign Policy, and also authored a book earlier this year in France on the views of the Democratic candidates for president. So welcome all, and thanks for joining us this morning. We will talk for about 45, 50 minutes, then we'll throw it open for questions, which you can relay in Twitter. I guess my first question is really on the news of the day. And we should start by saying, of course, our best wishes go out to the president and to all of those who are affected by this latest outbreak, and hoping for a speedy recovery. But Bill, I wanted to start with you. I mean, it seems that there's really no precedent for an event or development like this, certainly so close to an election It really creates additional uncertainty. It's also a global event, of course, because we're talking about the Commander-in-Chief of the United States, and there's lots of things that could happen on the international scene over the next 4 weeks and beyond, particularly if the president is impaired or incapacitated in any way. So we really have everything coming into the mix, national security, politics, personalities. I was wondering if you could give us your first sort of impressions of the gravity of this moment, and maybe some ways to think about it, and also how it's likely to feed into the election on November 3rd.
Well, Tom, your question anticipates my answer. It is all of the above and more. I think the general sense in the United States is that we are piling one disruptive event on top of another. If this had happened against a calm backdrop, it would have been one thing. But for it to happen while the rubble was still bouncing from the tumultuous presidential debate last week, while threats of interference with the U.S. election and the count of the ballots are in play, because the president of the United States has put them there. Plus, of course, the actual situation on the ground with the pandemic not under control, with the economy and the economic recovery appearing to slow and perhaps in danger of stalling altogether, with racial conflict and partisan polarization. This is an unprecedented situation. I am plenty old enough. I was an adult in 1968, and I have long said that 1968 was the worst year in American politics and society since the end of the Civil War. I'm in the process of revising that judgment. It may well be that the year we're enduring is in fact the worst since the Civil War. With regard to the election itself, this is at the very least a serious problem for the Trump campaign to be added to the roster of serious problems, including a decline in public opinion polls that it was already facing, in the following very direct sense. The game plan was that President Trump would barnstorm around the country in the last month of the campaign. He is widely viewed as his campaign's most important asset to be deployed. The Trump rallies are famous for their raucous enthusiasm, which appears to have ripple effects through the portion of the electorate that is inclined to vote for Mr. Trump. And it appears that for a substantial period of time, I would say at least the next 10 days, the Trump campaign will not be able to play its high card, and which will impede his prospects of coming from behind to catch Joe Biden at the wire of this race.
Thank you. Thanks, Bill. Fiona, if I could turn to you next. I mean, you worked with many of the people who are currently serving in the White House. I was wondering, there were media reports over the weekend just of, if not a general sense of chaos, just a great degree of uncertainty and concern about the continuity of government. And there's been some controversy around the Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, who I know came after your time there. But I was wondering if you could just maybe give us your sort of thoughts about how this is being sort of experienced by the officials who work on U.S. foreign policy. What impact is the president's illness likely to have on U.S. national security, and just any other sort of reflections you have on these latest developments?
Well, I think that what we're seeing here is the risks of having a hyper-personalized presidency. And this really fits into, you know, what Bill has already said. I mean, I think we're in a very unusual time when, you know, President Trump has very vocally, publicly and frequently stressed that he is the only person who matters in the system. And it would be very interesting to hear from, you know, Bill, again, as we go around, I'm sure there'll be questions about this, not just about the continuity of government, but about the whole, you know, delegation of authority in the case of incapacitation. Obviously, we've had that before in the past. But this is an administration in which the president doesn't like to delegate down authority. As I learned in the time that I was there, I think this came out very clearly in the testimonies this time last year. Nobody's really delegated with plenipotentiary authority to carry out the business of state. You know, if it can easily be undermined in a tweet, anything that you say, there's a question about whether anything that anybody else in the system says really matters. And so I think that, you know, just in short, this makes it very difficult for everybody else to go about their jobs. There's little confidence, apart from, I would say, on many of, you know, the kind of routine domestic issues, but certainly you asked about national security, that people can press ahead with anything. You know, we just recently saw that National Security Advisor O'Brien has gone off to meet with his counterpart, Nikolai Patrushev from Russia, the head of the equivalent of the National Security Council in Geneva. I mean, obviously, we did that many times when I was there in the National Security Council. And even then, at that particular set of junctures, which was much earlier on in the term, the Russians and others were always questioning about, you know, how authoritative were our interactions. We've moved along in an arms control negotiation with the Russians. It seems to have hit a crucial period. But as a month out of the election, with great uncertainty as to what's going to happen, you know, how can they really press ahead on some of these critical issues that, you know, like Bill is suggesting, require a calmer atmosphere? You know, it's very hard to make breakthroughs on critical issues like arms control, very sensitive and detailed and complex negotiations that are also very technical when you have so much chaos and uncertainty. So I think that this is, you know, as Bill was talking about, the domestic front, just a metaphor also for our national security. It's very hard for anyone who's there under these circumstances to get on with their job when it's not clear how much authority that they actually have.
Thank you. Celia, this is really the latest, you know, development, not just in US politics for the rest of the world, but also in the handling of the coronavirus. How is it being interpreted in France and in Europe, and what sort of the main lens through which they see the United States at the moment? Celia, you're on mute.
Thank you, Tom. Force of habit. Of course, Europeans are looking with great interest to what's happening to President Trump at the moment. Great interest, great concern, I must say. All the leaders have sent their sentiment of support, of concern for the president and his family. And of course, obviously, from the public or the media, you had some sarcastic comment, as it is well known that President Trump himself had adopted a position of doubt, let's say, regarding this virus. And so you had some coverage on it in the media in Europe, in France, in Germany, in the UK, obviously over the weekend. But in many ways, it sort of reinforces this preset European idea that what's going on in the US is that you have a country that is adrift, just a month out of the presidential election. The pandemic is not under control. The tensions, political tensions, are extremely high. As Bill said, you have crisis on top of each other. And there's a strong feeling since the beginning of this pandemic, or let's say 2 months into it, that the U.S. is not handling the crisis very well. There was a poll from the Pew Research Center mid-September that showed that Europeans considered, when they were asked who has done a good job in dealing with COVID, they were given pretty good marks for the EU, around 50-60%. Even more for their own country, around 60 or 70%, and quite high marks for China, around 40%. But the US note mark was abysmal, around 10 to 15% in some of the main European countries, considering that only 10 or 15% of people considered that the US was doing a good job dealing with COVID. So really, what this ultimate crisis will do is just reinforce this image. And there, at the same time, the Europeans' own sense of isolation. Who else than the US can be their ally in dealing with this pandemic? And at the moment, the American giant is missing, and its leadership is missing. And now more than ever, the presidential leadership is missing as well. So I was just thinking, listening to Bill and to Fiona, that the only thing really missing from this confluence of crisis is an international crisis. And hopefully, there's the US won't face that, but that would be a very weak moment, a very hard moment for the US at a time when power is concentrated around the president, and the president is or could be incapacitated. At least it's a worrying thought, even and also for Europeans.
Celia, I know, just to follow up, I know obviously the Prime Minister Boris Johnson got the coronavirus. Have there been any high profile instances of politicians in France contracting it?
So there's two politicians who have died from it, that were one in office and one that wasn't, Patrick de Vétian, who was a president of a regional council, and then another important figure of the Socialist Party, Henri Weber, who passed out, who died also from COVID early on in the process. But quite a few members of cabinet have been sick. Nobody as sick, or that I know of or can remember on top of my head, as sick as Boris Johnson. So it never felt as close to a crisis of leadership as it was in the UK, or as it's going on in the US. But, and of course, there was sort of a sense of relief that we have a young president at the moment. It's a little bit of just luck, but there was, especially at the height of the epidemic in April and May, I think it was a sort of comforting sentiment for some French. But I'm sure it is extremely troubling to have the highest function in the land being hit to this degree. And I just realized that I don't think Europeans feel it as much as Americans do. I've seen the coverage in the media here. It is extremely dramatic. I don't think it has crossed the Atlantic just yet.
Interesting. Bill, I just had one follow-up for you, and it's really to do with the mechanics of the election. So, I mean, there's lots of different scenarios that could happen over the next few weeks. President Trump could be back up and campaigning potentially. On the other hand, he could be quite sick. All of that could have an impact on the election. You know, people may, if he has to withdraw from the race, or who knows. But my question is, is the US electoral system sort of set up adequately to deal with the spectrum of possibilities? And when people go to the polls on November 3rd, I mean, in this respect, at least, if not the other respects of the normal, you know, issues that we've talked about before this weekend, is that likely to go smoothly? Or could we be facing a constitutional crisis, you know, with uncertainty about both the election and then the post-election period with the college?
That is a very large question, Tom. And let me try to subdivide it for purposes of clarity. The president's ability to get back on the campaign trail will be dictated to some extent by health considerations. But as we saw yesterday, this is a president determined to project an aura of strength and invulnerability. And we have good reason to believe that he will go to considerable, if not extraordinary, lengths to do that. And I expect that to continue. So unless he is really so ill that he must be confined to his bed in a hospital for an extended period, I would expect him to get back on the campaign trail, even against the advice of his doctors. This is just a speculation, but I think it's consistent with his character and conduct over a long period of time. Question number two, what would happen if he became so ill that he were in effect forced to withdraw as the presidential candidate? Here, there's no ambiguity. Both the Republican Party and for that matter, the Democratic Party, both have in place very clear legal mechanisms for replacing a national candidate, either the president or the vice president, in emergency circumstances. And I do not expect that to become a subject of contestation. We also have clear legal and constitutional processes for temporarily transferring power from the president to the vice president or people lower down in the chain of succession if that were to become necessary. So the question that is most imponderable has to do with the conduct of the election itself and the aftermath on election day. The president in the past has indicated that he distinguishes very sharply between the returns that are announced on the night of the election and the returns that are come in and are counted and announced after that. That could be a serious point of contestation and disruption because a record share of the votes in 2020 will be cast by mail, and many of those mail-in ballots will not be counted in time to be reported on election night. So as a legal matter, I think the situation is clear. Those ballots, to the extent that they're not invalidated because of technical violations by individual voters, will be counted. Whether the president will accept the count is a different question, but I don't think that's going to be a political question, not a legal question. I am a member of a number of organizations that have worked through a series of disaster scenarios. The sort of scenario like a nuclear meltdown to which one attaches a small probability, but which, if came to pass, would be absolutely catastrophic. Time does not permit me to go through all of those scenarios. Suffice it to say that both political parties have reviewed those scenarios in detail. It is within the realm of metaphysical possibility that one or more states would send competing slates of electors to participate in the final formal presidential selection process. If that were to happen, all bets are off.
Great. Well, assuming we get through all of that, assuming we do end up with the president in relatively quick order after the election, I'd like to turn now to the two sort of obvious scenarios for next year, Trump is reelected or Biden is elected, and to ask, you know, you all to sort of think through what that would mean for international politics, but also particularly for the transatlantic relationship. And let's start with Trump, and sort of, I know he's less likely, according to pretty much all of the data out there, to be reelected, but, you know, it is a possibility, obviously, and he defied odds last time. So let's assume that he is reelected. Fiona, if I could start with you, since you worked in the, you know, in the White House, and I know you've been thinking about this a bit, but I know we've talked about it separately, but it seems to me there's sort of two different, you know, broad scenarios with the Trump second term. One is that it's a little bit more like the last year. You know, we see some continuity there. He's trying to strike deals around the world. It's highly sort of personalized, but it's sort of similar to where we are right now. And the other is that it's sort of an exponential progression from that he, you know, it becomes hyper-personalized and he maybe doubles down on some of his instincts. Which is that sort of the right way to think about it? Or do you have another way of sort of conceptualizing it? And what do you think the main implications for Europe are? Former National Security Advisor John Bolton, who you worked with closely, has said he worries that Trump will pull out of NATO in a second term. You know, how worried should we be? And, you know, is there any prospect that this actually, you know, is not as bad as people would expect from a transatlantic perspective?
I think I already said in my last response that it is hyper-personalized already. I think we're there. And this is why everything is so fragile. You know, President Trump is literally the wild card in our political system right now. His health and what happens to that, whether he can campaign, all of the issues of worst case scenarios that Bill has played out for us. Everything will also hinge for a second term on how that second term comes about. Is it through an even smaller margin in the Electoral College or a bigger margin in the Electoral College because of, you know, various things we haven't caught in polling, but at the same time, a huge vote against the president, bigger than it even was before in the popular vote. I mean, that will all set the tone for the presidency, irrespective of any outside influence or, you know, anything else that's going on here. And if, let's play that scenario out, the president again scrapes through in the Electoral College, an even larger vote against him in the popular vote, he'll be on the defensive. Extremely defensive, more defensive than he already is. And you know, there'll be also larger questions about, you know, who will be key people in the cabinet, how many people will stay on, who will leave, particularly on the national security front. I mean, I can imagine a number of the president's closest associates who will be put into these positions. And then the question also then will be, again, will Congress and the Senate both be in the hands of the Republicans, or will there be a flip of the Senate as well over to the Democrats as a result of the elections? There are so many variables here that, you know, we could be playing out this game, you know, for quite some time. It's a numbers game for, you know, who's going to be in. But let's just say then that you know, you have the Senate and the Congress in Democratic hands. You can imagine just what a bruising fight it's going to be for replacing cabinet officials who decide to retire and, you know, kind of move on and do something else, and to get other people in place, particularly if they're people closest to the president and don't have the national security and foreign policy credentials of some of the others who've been in more recently. I do think a lot of the people who are already there will stay, some in the White House in the West Wing, but also, you know, in the different assistant and deputy assistant levels throughout the departments and agencies. And we should be very grateful for people staying on under, you know, quite difficult circumstances. The problem, of course, is a lot of people have been in acting. And I don't know enough about how this could all play out. We'd have to ask Bill about this, about how long can people stay in acting capacities when you start with a new term as well. And that will reduce, again, the ability to really do things. Getting back to what I said before, when you're not got full plenipotentiary delegated authority, it's very difficult for you to do your job and to interact with interlocutors who wonder, on whose behalf are you speaking? Because the president says everyone's speaking on his behalf and not on behalf of the country. He always makes that distinction. Now, on the specific questions, you know, that you've asked about NATO, you know, I think we can see a lot of the decision making is driven by disputes with other countries. And what's going on with NATO is really the question about matching 2% of GDP. Now, as a result of COVID-19 and the large-scale recession that we're seeing on a global scale, a lot of countries' GDPs will have fallen. And if their defense spending stays consistent, they will be already at 2%. There are a few countries close to that. So, you know, that might be the upside. That could take the edge off some of those debates and discussions. However, I somehow doubt it. And I think there will be a huge debate here. And Celia, it'll be interesting to, you know, to see what you think. Because we'll already have had Britain pulling out of Brexit, Britain wanting to figure out how to double down on NATO. We'll have tightened resources. There'll be an awful lot of questions about what's the perception of the threat. You know, should we be doing more on pandemic? Should NATO be doing more on pandemic? What about the rise of China? You know, how do we tackle Russia? We have so many things where there's contention. We have also the question about Europe, and will Europe build up its own defence capability? I mean, obviously France is very interested in that, and France also has a very close defence relationship with the UK. I can see, sadly, more room for divisiveness on NATO rather than less, if, you know, things follow the pattern that we've already seen unfold. And the president will also, I think, being very defensive on the home front, you know, be less interested in having a kind of a broader strategic approach abroad. I'll just flag one area where there is already a big crisis, Armenia, Azerbaijan. You know, the United States was always pretty critical in helping to manage Nagorno-Karabakh. You know, we have a grouping that includes France, includes the United States, includes Russia, that is trying to manage, or in the past was managing this dispute. We now see that the United States is missing in action. We didn't have to be. And in fact, you know, kind of a year or so ago, we were very much in the thick of the action. But now we see Turkey and Russia facing off over Nagorno-Karabakh and mirroring, you know, some of the developments that have happened in Syria. This is already, you know, kind of an example of what can happen when the United States isn't fully engaged. And to be honest, I'd be rather worried about us getting engaged, because we've also shown a propensity in recent conflicts to take sides, the role of a neutral arbiter. And given the large Armenian diaspora here, and, you know, the president's, I'll just say right out, the president's, you know, personal relationship with Kim Kardashian, who has been tweeting about Armenia. She's probably one of the most famous Armenians in United States culture, shares another. And I mean, there are more, because we have such a large Armenian diaspora. That is not a good sign for playing a neutral role here, in which we had previously. And the United States has very close relationships in the past with Azerbaijan. So you can already see the consequences of us being missing in action. And I'm not sure in this case that Europe will be able to pick up. But Celia, I mean, France also has a similar situation with Armenia, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. There's a large Armenian diaspora and close ties as well.
Celia, if we could turn to you on this. You know, we had sort of, I know, spoken about this before the pandemic. I think the feeling in Europe was that Trump was likely to be reelected, right? And certainly when I was at the Munich Security Conference in February, just before everything shut down, you know, the American delegation seemed to think that, you know, that it was either a very close race or that, you know, Biden would win. But the Europeans sort of uniformly just seemed almost, you know, maybe it was resigned to, or I'm not quite sure what, but they sort of assumed that he would be reelected because of the economy and because of where the Democratic primary was. And we're in quite a different point now, but sort of trying to go back and sort of put on that hat a little bit about what, you know, Europeans are thinking then about a Trump second term and maybe how it's evolved since. How would they be likely to react once the shock sort of wore off of the second surprise result? Would they conclude the US has permanently changed and this is the end to the transatlantic alliance? Or would they, as President Macron did for sort of at least 3 years, sort of assume, yeah, Trump's not ideal, but we can sort of work with him. And it's, you know, it's not too different to where the US has been normally. Could you walk us through maybe just what those policy planners and leaders would be thinking, say, in 6 or 8 months' time, if it is a second term of President Trump?
Yes, well, I think Europeans, by and large, up until maybe the convention, a little bit after that, still thought in the majority that Trump was likely to be reelected. Only recently have I started to see repeated experts saying repeatedly that, yes, Joe Biden has been ahead in the polls in a substantial margin. So there is a possibility of a Biden administration. But it's mostly as if Europeans want to prepare themselves for a second Trump administration. They want to prepare themselves psychologically, but to what I could see, they're not preparing very much in terms of actually anticipating the type of policy that could be put in place or the type of initiative that could be put in place with the second Trump administration. And part of the reason is that I think after 4 years, Europeans still haven't found sort of a remedy to Trump or a way to deal with Donald Trump. And Fiona said it, and you said it, because Trump's policy and foreign policy is so personal, it is anathema to Europeans, and it is something that both European institutions, European leaders, and even personalized, you know, presidential systems such as France have trouble dealing with because they have such a strong administrative bureaucratic state behind it that deals with a lot of all foreign policy decision. And they are have been taken aback for the past 4 years by the fact that engaging with the regular channels of the American administrative state has sometimes produced suboptimal results, or at least could be contradicted from one day to the other by decisions from the White House. So they still haven't found the formula. And the other example of this is that President Macron has tried to have a personal relationship, a good personal relationship with the president, and has tried this sort of personalized politics. But once again, it hasn't led to this proximity hasn't led to major policy results either. So if a second term is to be imagined, I think first Europeans will try to think whether President Trump would feel vindicated by a second wind. And in that case, as Fiona pointed out, whether he would be able to just go one step further, doubling down on some of his own instinct on trade, continuing or increasing trade pressures on the EU, continuing to retreat from global responsibilities, questions around NATO, obviously. And the other element that they're thinking about is that they know that Donald Trump is tactical, that maybe the way to engage him would be to engage him on specific issues and to offer, to offer for him to reach big deals or any sort of agreement that would put him in a good political light tactically, because it doesn't have to be rooted in a grand strategy. And in that case, maybe the Europeans have some elements that they can play with once again on the trade front. But overall, just to finish, I think there's a big question that combines right now and the long term, which is there's a question in European minds today on whether Trump's COVID diagnosis and COVID illness at the moment will ever change his mind on the way to deal globally and collectively with this issue. And, Europeans, as much as many other countries, have been waiting for U.S. leadership, at least U.S. participation on collective efforts on producing a vaccine, on distributing treatments, on working together on this issue. And the US has been strong bilaterally. It has helped more than 120 countries on a bilateral level during this crisis, but has failed to engage collectively, both in multilateral organizations, but also in sort of more ad hoc initiatives. So that would be the big questions for Europeans. Can Donald Trump ever change? And can he change based on personal experience? As he's mentioned in his videos, he said something like, I have gone to school with this COVID. I have learned things and I will go back on this and discuss this. So maybe that's the case, and it will give Europeans some hope, I guess.
Yeah, Celia, just to jump in there, we'll go to Bill in a second. I mean, you know, that sort of happened to Boris Johnson, right? He was very cavalier about it, joked about continuing to shake hands, and afterwards was quite chastened. But I don't see that happening with Trump. You know, last night he did make those remarks, which I thought were a bit odd, but did say he learned a lot about it. And then within hours, he went out in a van with the Secret Service in a very dangerous environment, you know, to his Secret Service agents to wave at the crowds. And I think that is, to me, I mean, that's a pretty significant episode, because what it shows is that, how irresponsible he's been internationally and nationally on this is no different than how sort of irresponsible he is when his own health is at risk, you know. And so this is just what he's like, I think, in terms of his approach to it. And I think to me, it makes me pretty worried, you know, that I think he may use it as a PR talking point. But I'd be very surprised if he, I think most people like the Prime Minister, you know, you could have that change, but I'm not sure we'll see it with him. But Bill, I know we're on Trump, you know, but back to the virus, but maybe a little bit on that, but also looking ahead to a second term. I mean, what do you think a Trump second term would look like on foreign policy? And is this sort of a real hinge moment? I mean, some people have described it as, you know, that this will be the definitive end to the post-war US-led international order because, you know, of his opposition to it. Is that overwrought or is that where we're headed?
No, Tom, I don't think it is overwrought. That is the way I see the stakes in this election. It was one thing to elect Mr. Trump in 2016. There was a widespread sense of discontent with the pace of the economic recovery. Many portions of the country felt entirely unseen and unheard by the previous administration. And Mr. Trump was a protest candidate, a classic protest candidate who parlayed a strong campaign and an outsider's disruptive message into the narrowest possible victory. The American people have now had 4 years to experience directly the consequences of this kind of governance. If they were to ratify it by giving Mr. Trump a second term, I would conclude that the America that I grew up in for nearly three quarters of a century has changed fundamentally. And I would be amazed if people around the world did not draw the same conclusion. Now, I grant everything that Celia and Fiona said about the specifics of different scenes of action and of different tactical possibilities. But the overall framework of understanding of the United States and its role in the world, I believe, would have to shift. And governments and peoples around the world would be blind not to make that intellectual shift and to, especially in Europe, rethink how it can do the best for itself in the absence of a United States that it can depend on. And let us remember that to depend on the United States ultimately is to depend on the American people. It is to depend on the understanding of the people that politics is to be contested at midfield. And not at one end of the goal or the other. And an electoral victory, a ratifying victory for Mr. Trump under these circumstances, I think would lead straight to the conclusion that the American people are more unstable and less reliable in their judgment in ways that affect the security of international alliances and international affairs. What would a second Trump term look like? My bet is on more of the same. And my reason for saying that is very simple. You know, as Fiona has insisted, this is a highly personalized administration where the formal structures of advice and decision-making are much weaker than they are customarily. Add that to your premise, Tom, that Mr. Trump is unlikely to fundamentally change his personality. So if you have a personality-driven administration and a personality that does not change, why would one expect anything else except more of the same? And that would be my prediction. And I do not say that welcoming it in the slightest.
Thanks, Bill. So Celia, maybe we'll turn back to you to look at Biden. And we'll go to Bill and Fiona after that as well. Celia, you spent quite a bit of time following the Democratic primary candidates around the campaign trail, including Vice President Biden, who I think it's safe to say at the time did not look like the front runner. And then you wrote a book about how sort of Democrats sort of see the world and what the implications of the election might be in terms of that sort of Democratic worldview and what it meant internationally. Could you sort of give us your impressions of what you think a Biden administration would be like, but in particular, how it might be received in Europe? And, you know, one would expect perhaps that it would be widely welcomed, but after that initial sort of welcome or sense of relief because of the troubles they've had with the Trump administration, what are some of the additional elements, including complications that might arise over the next year? Would there be any concerns that the French government or Europeans would have? What would the problems be, and what would the main areas of opportunities be as well?
Yes, indeed. I sort of completely misjudged Joe Biden. It's probably, you know, I can use my foreigner card. Sorry, I completely misjudged primaries. And I remember, Tom, telling you less than 2 weeks before South Carolina, you know, I had just seen Joe Biden in New Hampshire giving a speech to a room that was emptying out. And I was telling you, you know, the guy is done. This is done. This is over. And then 2 weeks later, you had a major win in South Carolina, and then obviously went on to become the nominee. And part of the reason I think I completely misjudged also was that I was first impressed by the progressive waves and the capacity of a large part of the electorate and the candidates to be ideological. And so probably closer to European politicians than they are to American politicians that tend to build coalition and that tend to find the center of gravity rather than push ideological ideas. But I think the strength in the Democratic Party at this juncture is to have both. You have both the progressive ideological elements on the ground, feeding the battle of idea, feeding, you know, the youth and people that want to be engaged for a reason. But then they sort of rallied around a candidate that can embody all of this because he can embody everybody at the same time. And he's able to sort of, as he said, be a bridge between sort of the more traditional Democratic Party and the younger progressive wing of the party. But so that raises a big question in my mind regarding foreign policy. Will Joe Biden be a transformational candidate? Will he be? Will he bring progressive ideas to his foreign policy? But he's also coming in a specific context, as we mentioned earlier, the context of this multiple era of crisis, mostly internal, but the pandemic, the economic crisis, the racial crisis, also the climate crisis, all at the same moment, and which will weigh very heavily on his capacity to do foreign policy. So the other big question is that will a Biden administration be inward looking, or will it be able to do what he says he wants to do, which is restore U.S. leadership? And there's always a caveat to restoring U.S. leadership is that most of his advisor will say it starts at home. You have to start by rebuilding America's strength at home to rebuild credibility in the world stage. But I think it's this articulation of inward looking and trying to restore U.S. leadership that's going to create a tension, but that's also at the core of the, probably the first year at least in office. I would say that I would identify also three main points that I think are of high interest for partners and allies around the globe. The first point is that there's a question on the on competition with China. And I think it's more than likely than that the overall US-China competition will remain as a framework for foreign policy in the foreseeable future. And that has, you know, implications both because the U.S. will want once again to restore its strength vis-a-vis China. So a lot of investment, you know, Joe Biden has talked about investing in research and development, investing in infrastructure, including a green energy transition and investment. But it also has implications for relationship to allies, in particular, if there's a tendency to sort of confront models, the authoritarian model embodied by China versus the democratic model embodied by the US, in which case one of the priority for Biden and his administration will also be to strengthen democracy at home, which we've discussed has been, to say the least, hurt by the last few years and the divisions in this country, as well as decisions from the leadership. So strengthening democracy will be a core issue. Last two points that are also priorities. One is a dialogue with allies and partners. Joe Biden has talked repeatedly about restoring alliances. He hopes to restore these alliances also as an, you know, could to counter the influence of authoritarians around the world. And he has suggested that he would have a summit or summit of democracies in next year, or at least some form of acknowledgement of the importance of allies and like-minded in some form. I think it could evolve in the next few months should he be elected. The last point is that because you have this confluence of priority looking inward and competition with China, I think there's going to be a huge priority given to geo-economic issues. So it means focusing on innovation, focusing on cyber issues, focusing on trade, focusing on climate action. All of this meaning that these are the areas where the U.S. can compete in the world, can invest, but it's also profitable at home. And this will reduce the interest for traditional military intervention. As we can imagine, there's just a continuation on this front of disinterest to have, since the Obama administration, disinterest for major military intervention, which is probably just as good, but a strong emphasis on geoeconomic issues, which can then find a partner, I think, in the EU. That's sort of the priority of the European Commission. That's the priority of many European countries that don't feel, and I'm not specifically talking about France there, but feel more at ease with geoeconomic issues than maybe with geopolitical issues, and could find some common interest on working on climate action, on cyber issues, on trade, etc. Overall, I think people are expecting a sort of a gentler America. New York Times has talked about strategic empathy for Joe Biden, but he will face a world that has, you know, has grown angrier and more resentful, and that might not be so ready to see such a partner return to the White House. So there's going to be a lot of work ahead.
Thank you, Celia. We're going to go in after we go to Bill and Fiona to audience questions, because we've got some of those. But before we do, Bill, could you just give us a brief analysis of what you think a Biden administration would be like, sort of, you know, in particularly in terms of what one might not expect, right? So what might the some of the developments that might be sort of surprising to people?
Well, actually, Tom, I expect the expected. And I say that because Joe Biden is the ultimate traditionalist. His entire political personality has been formed over a period of five decades in public life around the sorts of arrangements that characterize the post-war world. And my view is that he will try to shore up the architecture of what he's most familiar with while pushing forward on some of the new transnational issues. So I think obviously there will be a renewed focus, perhaps greater than ever before, on climate issues viewed in an international context. I think that there is likely to be a renewed emphasis on international and transnational cooperation on health issues. So all in all, you know, I think that there will be a certain amount of new wine, but it will be in the same old bottles. And most of the people around Biden who are likely to adopt senior positions in his administration are, by and large, traditionalists. They believe in the post-war order, not because it was perfect, but because it was preferable to all the available alternatives. I would expect a Biden administration to be tougher on China than Biden's own history would suggest, simply because circumstances have changed. But unlike the current administration, I would expect him to work very hard to construct a coalition to confront China. And the European Union, I think, would be partner number one in the construction of that coalition. Partner number two would be the democracies in East Asia and the Pacific. So policy innovation, I think, is more to be expected on the Chinese front than on any other.
Thanks, Bill. It's fascinating. My own take on it, in part, I agree with that. But I think if you look, what's interesting to me is within the Biden world, there's actually sort of an interesting debate going on. You know, so they all believe in alliances and the international order, but there's some relatively significant differences about how to deal with that. And I think I find it interesting to ask, you know, not just how Biden would be different to Trump, but if he will be different to Obama, you know, if Biden 1 will be different to Obama 3. So I don't know, maybe there'll be sort of a synthesis between the two. But I suspect we may see, once the election is over, some of those debates coming to the fore a bit more, because right now, you know, just by being in favor of alliances, Biden is very different to Trump, but that doesn't tell us a huge amount, you know, about what Biden will be like, because there's lots of different ways to be pro-alliance, you know, but we will see. Did you want to come back in on that, and then we'll go to Fiona?
No, except to say, just to reemphasize, that the Obama-Biden administration was the end, or presided over the end of the old confidence that Chinese economic integration would give China incentives to play by the global economic rules and would lead to a progressive liberalization. Nobody believes that anymore, not in the Democratic Party and not in the Republican Party. So in that respect, it will not be the third Obama term. Not possible.
Thank you. Fiona, your take on a Biden administration, maybe also with a little twist, if you're willing, is there anything in the Trump administration, you know, excluding the president, but in the Trump administration's approach, whether it's in the national security strategy, national defense strategy, or any of the things you or others are working on that they should maybe think about keeping? Will there be any points of continuity there, do you think, or will it be very, you know, a sort of a sharp contrast with the Trump administration?
Thanks, Tom. And I'm sorry to everybody who's watching, because I'm actually getting emails from people saying, why do you keep looking out of your window? I had to break off at a moment, because I'll use this as a segue to what I want to say, because Pepco, the infamous electricity company, showed up to cut down the tree outside of my window unannounced, and I had to go and move the car. Which gets to the point where nothing stays constant and unexpected change comes along. I had no idea they were going to do this morning. So, and I'm looking nervously in case a big branch comes through the window, because they seem to be recklessly cutting things around. So if I'm taken out by a branch, I apologize to everybody. Anyway, what I do want to stress here is, just as Bill emphasize that the Biden and Obama administration, Obama-Biden administration, was presiding over the end of really the confidence or the assumption that China would adapt to the kind of the larger international environment. We can't basically say that we can go back to anything that was before. What worries me, and I'm sure worries a lot of people, when people keep talking about going back, as Celia has said very eloquently, Europe's moved on. Europe was already moving on under the Obama administration. In some respects, some of the foreign policy posturing that we now see here at home in the United States was a reaction to that whole idea that Obama was leading from behind, which, of course, was a notorious phrase from somebody within the administration. And Celia, Tom, Anu, and many others have written, there was already something of a feeling in Europe that the United States had sort of moved on. It wasn't just because they'd moved on and pivoted to Asia, but they were, you know, rethinking the whole US position. There was a lot more reluctance to be involved in the Middle East, and a lot more reluctance to be involved in all kinds of places where the United States in the 1990s in particular and in the 2000s stepped up. And I'd already mentioned Nagorno-Karabakh, which most Americans haven't thought about since 1994 when the last ceasefire was brokered. So there's all kinds of issues that behind the scenes the United States was managing in terms of conflicts and, you know, the whole ecosystem in international security has changed now. China has risen. It's not just rising anymore. It's the dominant player in the Asia and Indo-Pacific region. We've seen the clashes with China and India on their very fragile border. We know that China means business. You know, the fact that they've killed several Indian soldiers should be a wake-up call that, you know, China will not necessarily continue to manage things in its own neighborhood as it has before. So we're going to be really confronted with a whole series of issues. And climate change is inescapable. Fires burning, you know, from California to Siberia. Everything that we know is changing here. Again, the whole global perspective is changing. There is no back to go back to. And what worries me a little bit about the Biden administration used to talk about this, as you know, what Bill is saying about it being kind of conventional to expect the expected. We are in unexpected, uncharted territory globally at this particular juncture. The pandemic, you know, should certainly have concentrated everyone's minds and focused on the fact those kinds of risks are ahead. I do think that that gives us some opportunity, however, you know, to work more closely with our allies. And there are some structures that I hope an incoming Biden administration will try to keep in place. Some of them have, you know, disappeared somewhat, but, you know, there are very good deputy assistant secretaries in the government. I really hope there will not be a purge of personnel because an incredible number of people have stayed on behind the scenes and have really tried to keep the ship of state steady and running. And, you know, they should be commended for that action, not condemned. You know, the last thing we need is yet another kind of bloodletting within, you know, the bureaucracy. We have to remember that US officials are for in the vast majority are like the rest of the United States. They reflect the composition of the population across all of the government, state and local, as well as the federal government. There's a lot of military veterans. It's really the senior executive service, which tends to be old, whiter, male, you know, who've, you know, kind of continuity from the past. But we were in the business of trying to revitalize the US federal government at this point. We need to put trust back in, but we need to see our public servants not as radically unelected deep state bureaucratic coup plotters, which is quite a mouthful, but as representatives of the best of the United States, and need to kind of get back to affirming, you know, their hard work on the behalf of the country. The National Security Council, when I was there, also set up some structures for engaging with counterparts. The recent visit to Geneva by National Security Advisor O'Brien and Deputy Matt Pottinger is one of a long sequence of meetings with Nikolai Patrushev and his team that I do think should be continued, because it's a way of passing on tough messages, not just of, you know, moving ahead on things like START and arms control. So there are some structures out there, task forces that were set up with governments, new relationships that were being forged with some other European players that need to continue. But we also will need a wholesale, I think, reassessment of some of those critical relationships that have just become so frayed that the only anchor is the relationship between the president and the other person on top. So there'll be a lot to do, but I would just please not a bloodletting and a purge of all personnel. Take a long, hard look at some of the people who've been there. A lot of people are just really good public servants. And there are some structures that could be useful for moving ahead with national security issues.
Thank you, Fiona. So we now will turn to audience questions, and we only have about 10 minutes. So what I'm proposed to do is to direct a couple of questions from members of the audience to each of you. And if you could all be relatively brief in the answers, so just so we can get through them. Celia, if we could start with you, of two questions here. One from Michael Randy Ellis, who asks, how can the U.S. earn back global trust after the Trump presidency? And another one from Maria Navakis, who asks, could Europeans develop an independent defense alliance if Trump withdraws the U.S. from NATO? Both of those, I think, probably evoke fairly sort of strong feelings in Paris in terms of European defense and also what a Biden administration might need to do. So if you could give us your thoughts on those, please.
Well, there's many, these are very open questions. The first question, if I remember correctly, is what to do to regain trust, right? What could the US do? And it probably depends who you're asking. So I'm going to try to answer as a European, but probably I'm going to answer as a French woman. So there's the minimum of the minimum would be to just re-engage and work cooperatively after years of not working together and being in competition with each other. We all remember the President Trump's famous sentences, the EU is worse than China. These were just explanatory of his own trade policy, but in many ways it has profoundly disrupted Euro-American relations along the lines that are we not working together? There's always been a strong competition on the economic sector, a competition between the two sides of the Atlantic, but the idea was always that this was healthy competition to make our societies, our economies, our markets just better, and not a competition to diminish the other and to win over the other. So the idea of just returning to a sort of a win-win cooperation, at the minimum, engaging in conversation, engaging in dialogue would be important. There is a specific case that maybe I want to underline, which is the idea that with this pandemic, and it has been going on now for years, obviously, there's a very strong conscious in Europe of the importance of the climate crisis. And the idea that the US has been missing in action completely since at least the Paris Agreement and since Donald Trump came to power is very unsettling for Europeans who are looking at this crisis as a sort of, the COVID crisis times a million, just because its effects will be lingering for decades, because its devastation will be infinitely more important, and just because the collective, there's only one way out of this crisis, at least to manage as much as we can this crisis, which is a collective answer. So the best way for the US to re-engage in the world would be to pick such an important crisis and to really work with its allies and partner on it. Second point, what about a European defense allies in case Trump or the US leaves NATO? I think this is too far ahead, too far down the line. We're not there yet. When President Macron talked about a brain dead NATO, people considered that he was talking about the end of NATO. What he was really talking about was that NATO was moving around without its head, meaning without any leadership. And leadership should come from more than the US, but at least the US is fully required. And which means that even within NATO, you have tensions between member states, including Turkey and many member states, including France, where the US not only opinion, but leadership weight would be extremely valuable. So maybe the first thing that Europe's need at this point is a sort of a re-engagement on what do we do with NATO? Do we also work and utilize NATO to deal with more global challenges including pandemics, including the future climate crisis, but also what do we do with the security environment for Europe and in general, the rivalry or the competition with China. There are many, many topics to discuss already at the NATO framework. And if this was to not be productive, to disappear, I think Europe, also pushed by France, will continue its conversation on strategic autonomy, or at least some form of strategic conscious strategic organization for Europe to build some capabilities, hopefully in cooperation with NATO, but worst case scenario, to have started to prepare a Europe cut loose from its American ally.
Thanks, Celia. Fiona, I know you wanted to come in, but I have two questions for you as well. So you could follow up on what Celia said, but also if you could just address these. So the first one is on Turkey, which is appropriate, I guess, today. But, where are U.S.-Turkey relations headed, either under Biden or Trump? Obviously, they've been pretty fraught over the last few years, although Trump has consulted quite frequently with Erdogan. So where do you see the U.S.-Turkey relationship going? And then the second question is from Carrie Fraser, who asks, without U.S.-European coordination, can the U.S. sustain its influence as an international actor? And I guess what that question is asking is, there are those in the Trump orbit, maybe including the president himself, who thinks the U.S. doesn't need Europe and the U.S. is slightly tied down. Is that sort of a plausible worldview, and could it run into two obstacles?
Thanks. Actually, I'll take that first, and hopefully people can't hear. That was a wood chipper just outside my window. You probably can't hear it, so I'll just kind of press ahead. The issue about leadership and influence are tied together, correct? I mean, if you only have the ability to lead if you have influence, and you don't get influence through coercion. I mean, influence is done as it's part of teamwork, of working together with others and having allies. And if we look at countries that don't have any alliances, like Russia, for example, which has Putin and Trump actually have a very similar view that alliances are just encumbrances, that they're kind of really consist of other countries that want you to do something for them. Well, that actually isn't really what an alliance is about. An alliance is what Celia was describing, which is where countries are standing together trying to figure out how to deal with problems. And without the allies and the close alliances, with not just Europe, but Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Japan, India, the kind of relationships the United States has been developing globally, the United States will be forced to coerce countries. It'll be more of the kind of spats over trade that Celia was referring to. Because when, just as she said, when President Trump said that Europe was worse than China, he was meaning about trade and seeing the European Union as a competitor, but as a competitor that ought to be rolling over and giving the United States unfettered preferences in trade because the United States was in charge of its protection. And this gets really to the issue of NATO, because the way that NATO has been talked about is almost like kind of a protection scheme. Now, of course, it was set up as a protection scheme, but as mutual protection, all of us working together after World War II and during the Cold War. But President Trump was talking about it at different times that I heard and all of us have heard, more like the end of the Roman Empire, where the Romans would show up and sack a city if they hadn't paid their protection money. I mean, that was really not how NATO was envisaged. So that really kind of gets into that point about what do you do with NATO. If we get back to the thought that it is collective defence and a kind of mutual basis for cooperation on the bigger problems of the day, how to tackle the threats, then that will put us in a better stead for moving ahead. The difficulty will be of trying to come up with a new vision for NATO, and I think that perhaps we should just not do that. If you think about 2010, when there was a great big exercise to have a new doctrine for NATO, given everything that we've talked about today, that the environment is not propitious for this as well. And the threats are different from what they were after World War II and during the Cold War. They're not just in the form of countries or even non-state actors like terrorism. They are global pandemics. Are they going to be the issues of climate change, mass migration, you know, personally dealing with parts of Europe as well as the United States that might become, frankly, uninhabitable? And what NATO gives us is the patterns and a long experience of working together, not just of our militaries, but on the civilian side as well. The Secretary General of NATO, Stoltenberg, has actually been very good at leadership, but he can't lead without the participation of the rest of the member countries. And that gets us into Turkey. Turkey, the relationship has become, and I keep using this term, it's becoming hackneyed now, hyper-personalized. It's just the relationship between Trump and Erdogan at this stage. There are still military relationships, but while Turkey is ambivalent, you know, about its participation in the European arena, and is bogged down in Syria and is now jumping into the fray between Armenia and Azerbaijan over Nagorno-Karabakh and taking sides here in a way that it hasn't previously. 1994, Turkey was instrumental in helping with Russia to broker the ceasefire over Nagorno-Karabakh between Azerbaijan and Armenia and the Karabakhi Armenians. It's now playing a much more divisive and interventionist role. We've seen Turkey flexing not just its muscles, but creating all kinds of upheaval in the Eastern Mediterranean, fighting with Cyprus and Greece over territory and energy exploration, falling out with Israel after decades of having a close strategic partnership with Israel. We also, our own US-Turkish relationship has been on the rocks since Iraq, and it is not fixed just by having the two guys at the top sitting down and trying to work it out. Or what we've seen is also the son-in-law diplomacy between Jared Kushner and al-Barak, you know, over the Middle East peace process and the new Middle East plan and all kinds of other things that have been discussed there. We need to have a structure. And I think the only way to put the Turkish-US relationship as well as the Turkish-European relationship back on track is to do that in the NATO context. It's too divisive in Turkey's relationship with the EU, but there are many key European partners, including France and Germany and other countries that Turkey has close relationships with, like Britain, where actually the British-Turkish relationship is a bit more multifaceted still these days, where you could have a discussion, a serious discussion with Turkey about the future. So not on big picture, but trying to deal with these in perhaps a structured but ad hoc way on problem solving rather than coming up with big doctrines.
Thank you, Fiona. So we're pretty much out of time. Bill, I do have one question from you, and it comes from, this will be our final question. It comes from Garrett Mitchell, who asks, how would you look at Trump's second term scenario in the event that Democrats took the Senate, an unlikely combination of electoral outcomes, I admit, he says, but one that, of course, is possible. So if you could answer that maybe and give any sort of closing remarks, and then we'll wrap up.
Well, because this is a panel on foreign policy, I'll make the obvious point, and that is that the president's power is at its zenith in the conduct of foreign policy, unless there is the need to submit a formal treaty to the Senate for ratification, or unless a particular foreign policy venture implicates appropriation, requires appropriations in order to sustain it. But of course, even there, President Trump has demonstrated that he believes the executive has authority to shift funds around within budgets and between budgets. He's been able to get away with it so far, and in a second term, he would continue that. So I think that a Democratic Senate would not particularly fetter him in the conduct of foreign policy. Let me make two concluding points. First of all, European strategic autonomy is a meaningless phrase unless Germany is willing to rearm. That is the pivot around which the idea of a Europe able to defend itself will revolve. And I am waiting for some serious German thinking on that question, which I have not seen for a very long time. Concluding thought number two, FDR in the 1930s saw that an America that was an isolated democracy was an America that was an endangered democracy. That was the ultimate source of his engagement on the side of European democracies. He was right then, and that is still correct today. The United States, in its own self-interest, must restore its standing as the leader of the world's democracies. And I am I'm encouraged by the fact that former Vice President Biden, from the earliest days of his campaign, has espoused that principle quite firmly. And I hope very much that if he's elected, he will carry it through.
Bill, Celie and Fiona, thank you so much for joining us this morning, which I thought was a very fruitful and interesting discussion, very timely. Thank you also to Suzanne for opening up the proceedings, and to TUSIAD for sponsoring today's event. So we look very much look forward to engaging with all of you in the future. Thank you for joining us today on YouTube, on Zoom, and on online. And we look forward to our next conversation. And with that, we're adjourned.